Hello, everybody. We're back with Dakar Rally Daily from Cycle News, and I'm Jesse Ziegler.
And I'm Quinn Cody.
And we are with the final stage of this race, finally.
Final stage. Stage 12, episode 21 for us, man. Yep.
It's been a grueling race for these heroes out there. To set it up a little bit, stage 11 yesterday finished with Ricky Brabec, the defending champion, in third. In front of him was Sam Sunderland on the KTM, and then in front of him was Kevin Benavides. So we have Monster Energy Honda 1 and 3, Red Bull KTM sandwich in the middle.
Yep. So the top three riders were within 7 minutes on the general classification at the end of yesterday's stage.
Right. So for Ricky to regain and repeat his victory, he would have to gain 7 minutes on his teammate, 7 minutes and 13 seconds.
Yep. And he was starting 9 minutes behind, so he had the potential to do it.
He had a course in front of him, a relatively short stage in this race, somewhere around 200 kilometers.
Traditionally, the final stage of the rally has been kind of a parade into the finish. Not a lot of tricky navigation, just kind of, you know, mail it in. But this year, the organization actually put up a pretty significant final stage with some navigation, some sand dunes.
Yeah.
So the potential was there to see a shakeup in the general on the final stage.
Yeah, we saw some people getting lost. We saw some people getting confused.
Yep.
We saw a lot of people getting time taken out of their day.
Yeah.
And so big news is, did Ricky do it?
Right.
Could he make up that much time chasing his teammate down?
He did win the stage.
Right. He came in. He won the stage.
But unfortunately for Ricky and all the American fans, he finished only 2 minutes and 17 seconds ahead of his teammate, Kevin Benavides.
Right.
The big news is he did jump up in the general classification. So Ricky Brabec finishes second.
Competes
ahead of Sam Sunderland. Sunderland bled time today. He lost 13 minutes to Ricky Brabec.
Yep. So what we're looking at now is a Honda 1-2 on the final podium of the Dakar. And that is a remarkable finish for that marquee. Really shows the team strength. But, I mean, that's the first time Honda's been the top two step in the podium since 1987.
Yeah, that was a long time ago, before Ricky Brabec was born.
Yeah, so he's really carrying that, the Wing brand proud up there, bringing it up. Sam had some struggles today. It was his race to win, too. If he could have sprinted away from everybody and put time on Kevin as well, he was in a decent spot, but a real big challenge for Sam to lead the stage and make up time on Kevin.
Yeah, it was interesting to watch, because what it looked like to happen, I stayed up last night and decided to watch this thing. I couldn't fall asleep not knowing what was going to happen. So
had to binge it up.
Yeah, I was really, really rooting for Ricky Brabec to have the ride of his life and suck up that 7 minutes on his teammate. But really what happened was Kevin Benavides caught Sam Sunderland within the first 50 kilometers.
Yeah.
And then basically led out the rest of the stage and led out like a hero.
And barely lost time. He lost 2 minutes is all, to Ricky, who was charging from the back with a much more defined course in front of him and a lot more determination to catch someone. As it's kind of easier catching someone when you know they're in front of you than it is to run away from somebody chasing you. You make more mistakes. You get all tense and stuff when you're running away. Did not faze Kevin Benavides much at all.
No, Kevin, he kept it together. He charged from the front, leading out the stage, and won this rally today.
Yeah, he crushed it today.
No one can take that away from him. He, he earned it, and he had Ricky Brabec. Ricky was motivated, and it was pretty amazing to watch.
I bet going into the stage, Ricky probably wished that someone else was out there to chase, because he's ridden with Kevin so much. He knows his strengths. They train together a lot. They know that the bikes are solid. I bet he was charging as hard as he could, but at the end of the day, he knows that Kevin's just a really strong competitor.
Yeah, and I think with only 200 kilometer stage, it just wasn't enough time. And again, you're starting to come in to more closer to civilization, and maybe the course is a little more defined on where you're going, and the organization doesn't want to throw crazy, crazy navigation and tricky stuff on at them on the last day because they want to get everyone in. They want to get everyone to the finish podium. And
yeah, they got a party to a celebration, a TV crew's waiting. It is still somewhat of a subdued stage, but
right,
2 hours and 17 minutes is what Ricky took out on the course today. That's how long he was racing. Kevin was only out there, like we said, for 2 minutes longer total on the time thing. But here's a comparison to give you how well Kevin rode. This shows how well Kevin rode today to me. He caught the leader in like 50K. So he had 150K or so alone. Yep. And his average speed was only 1 mile an hour slower than Ricky.
And opening the stage.
Opening the stage.
No tracks to follow. He's doing all the navigation.
Yeah, 1 mile an hour. And by the way, that was 53 miles an hour compared to Ricky's 54 miles an hour. So the pace is still really high. And Kevin just put it together.
Yeah. It's a, you know, very impressive. I mean, this rally as a whole has been just a battle. And, you know, it's not one of those races where, you know, there's kind of an asterisk next to it that, you know, oh, this guy crashed out or this guy didn't show up. I mean, this was just a straight up battle from day one.
Really was.
You know, the Honda guys have really proved their strength this year.
Yep. Let's hear from Kevin Benavides at the end of the race, just to get his reaction. Some points. He's the first person from Argentina to win the rally.
It's first South American to win the rally.
First South American to win the rally, which is going to be a huge pride moment for that country, or that continent. It's his fifth time racing. So he's put in the work. He's been up there. He's been a contender.
Yeah. I mean, I've been watching Kevin for a long time now. And I've always said he's one of the guys that will probably win the rally. And, you know, I had him a couple of years ago to win you know, when the race was still in South America and he just wasn't able to put it together. So it's pretty cool to see him put it together this year.
Let's hear from Mr. Benavides.
Yeah, but what absolutely crazy. You know, I started third and then after 50Ks, I was in front opening the stage. So I feel that everything was complicated, you know, because Ricky started back on me. So I start to push a lot all day. So I stay focused. So I did a good job today. And also I go like 110%. But now it's true. I won Dakar, so I am so, so happy.
During 2 weeks, you did a perfect navigation, so it was a key, maybe.
No, yeah, I did some mistake for sure. I think it's impossible to make one Dakar perfect, you know. But the important thing is always continue, stay calm, and focus day by day, and work day by day. Yeah, stage five, that stage, I feel maybe that because I hit so fast, also with my head and my ankles, so I feel a lot of pain. On that day I say, oh, maybe the car is finished, but I continue pushing. Now I have some pain, but no, I am more happy than pain, so no problem.
When do you think you win the race?
Today in the last kilometer. You can't think nothing during this Dakar. You have to stay focused and don't think, just, you know, action and no more, because everything can change in 1 second.
How proud are you to be the first South American to win this race?
Really proud. My dream also was to make history, and I am the first guy to South American guy to win Dakar, so that is amazing for me.
Honda 1 and 2 is also a great team victory.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. We did a really good job in all the Dakar, you know, like a teammate. Nacho had a really bad crash, and also Joan, but we did a really good job like a team.
Very cool.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, he said it right there. He had to race to the last kilometer.
Yeah, he was pinning it today, and really cool to think back on stage five when he knocked himself and broke his nose and hurt his ankle. And was shaken.
Yeah,
sure.
Smashed his face on the navigation tower. You could clearly see he had a broken nose and sprained ankle. And you know, he kept fighting. And you know, he won the stage that day too. When he when he knocked himself. So
yeah, that's very, that very was impressive ride by that Kevin was kind Mays. Of that shift that we talked about where everybody, my everybody being me, was like, whoa, these guys aren't losing time now. They're staying in front and it's going to be just a battle.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the terrain changed a little bit. Things shook up. Guys started to wear down. And, yep. you know, then that's when the really good navigators kind of came to the surface.
Yep. That's about the same time Ricky found himself in a pretty tough spot. Ricky made a strategic move in the early parts of this stage to get out of the swing, get out of the nonsense of these massive time swings and try to control the race in a position standpoint so that he can get everybody sort of more aligned and, you know, get the race under control. And it wasn't necessarily a bad idea. It just didn't work the very next day when it had to, because he made a few navigation mistakes and it compounded sort of the time he lost. Right.
I think when they chose to start back a little bit, it was a good idea. It was a good strategy. It just didn't play out for him the following day. He made a couple errors and lost time again the following day
and put himself back into the swing that he was trying to avoid.
Right. And I mean, they were trying something and it was a big, bold move.
Yeah.
But maybe, you know, I mean, it's anyone's game to say what could have happened.
Yeah.
You know, they could have waited another day or two for the race to kind of come to them. You know, that's what Benavidez did. He just fought the whole way and let the race come to him. And, you know, so possibly they jumped the gun a little bit with the strategy, but who's to say, you know, it could have gone completely the other way.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of stage six, Ricky was in 13th place, 20 minutes behind Toby Price in the lead. And Kevin was sitting in second place, only 2 minutes behind Toby Price. And the performance that Ricky put on in that second half of the race, hammering down when he needed to crawl back that time little by little. And it wasn't like he made 20 minutes up in a day. Those days were over at that point.
Right. He's had a really strong second half of the race, a really good marathon stage.
Yep.
You know, he's won a couple of key stages and, you know, he made up 14, 15 minutes of that time that he was down after stage six.
Yeah. I think the team effort came into play there. Honda had a nice streak there where they won stage after stage after stage until Sam broke that up with the last stage that he won. So yeah. Honda was really showing dominance in the second half of this rally as well.
Yep. And, you know, Sam, he won the Queen stage. He won the big one. It was the key stage that everyone was looking to. And, you know, he won it, but today he just wasn't able to hold it together. And,
yep.
you know, I don't think he had the intensity of the Honda guys. I don't think he had as much left in the tank when it coming to the last day. And, you know, unfortunately it knocked him back a position and, you know.
Yeah, agreed. I'd like to hear from Ricky, get his reactions from the race, because second overall. Pretty awesome, and he came back from a deficit.
I think most people would be pretty damn happy with a second in a Dakar, but you know,
I have a feeling Ricky's not that happy about second.
It's tough when you win last year and you want to return as a champion, or you know, you want to repeat.
Yeah, you can hear it in his interview we did before the race. If you want to go back and listen to that, he's like, winning is the best thing in life always, and that's the only thing I want to do. So let's hear his reactions after the stage where he crawled into second place.
Yeah, you know, we tried our best. Unfortunately, our teammates riding really well, and you know, it's pretty cool to go 1-2, but obviously the top step's a lot better than the second step. You know, we did our best. We struggled the first week, but the second week I feel like we came back pretty strong. Today we gave it 110% and just it wasn't enough. I was hoping to catch up, but we'll take a second for now, and I guess we'll come back next year and try to get on the top again.
But the crown stay in the Honda team, so it's not a victory for you, but it's a team victory as well.
Yeah, you know, it takes a village to get this to happen, and I'm pretty bummed. You know, the number can't stay with me, but number two will work, I guess. You know, like I said earlier this week, you know, anything less than winning is unacceptable. So, I mean, yeah, we finished and we got second, but we could have done better. So, yeah, we'll go back, we'll go home, we'll take some time off, and we'll try to work harder than we did last year to make it to second place this year.
What could you have done better?
You know, I don't really know. We started out the rally opening the first day, and you know, with the new roadbook system, it was really tough. You know, they did all these crazy notes and more obliques and more moys and, you know, three caps in one note, and it was really difficult. So first guy on the road on the first stage, it was difficult. You know, we had to go first and try to figure it out, but as the rally went on, we figured it out, and you know, we're gonna take a book back home and study the book and try to do our best to make our own books that are similar so we can come back stronger next year.
Maybe it was one of the most difficult Dakar of the last year, let's say, last 10 years maybe.
Oh yeah, you know, this is only my sixth year, but it was definitely difficult. You know, the road book was tough, the train was tough, so yeah, I mean, hopefully next year they're gonna stay the same, and you know, we'll be more prepared next year.
And we can see more riders at the high level.
Yeah, you know, this is cool. You know, they kind of got, you know, the road book's super difficult, so that way the results were kind of flip-flopping back and forth, and you know, it brought other riders closer to the top, and you know, that's really good. And at the end of the day, we won 1 and 2 by, I don't know, a minute or something. So it was really close. And Sam's in third with, you know, I don't know, 2 minutes or something. So we went pretty good. You know, all the results are really close. So this makes for a good TV show at home, and this makes for a wild Dakar, you know, and no strategy really.
Do you know when was the last 1 and 2 for Honda?
I don't even know if Honda ever went 1 and 2.
It was in 87.
Oh, yeah. See, I wasn't even born in 87. So, yeah, no, it's cool to go 1 and 2 again. Unfortunately, Juan retired yesterday, and it would be really cool to have him on the podium as well, you know, but he would have to fight pretty hard. But if we went 1, 2, 3, that would be legendary. I'm pretty stoked, you know, to be I guess one of the only Americans to be on the podium twice, or to be the only American to win this thing. And we went number one last year and number two this year. So, you know, we're just adding to the Dakar trophy family.
The victory is staying in America, in the South now, but...
Yeah, you know, Kevin rode a good race. He's a really good teammate. Him and Nacho are really strong. Juan is strong as well, but... yeah, I mean, it kind of sucks that we don't get to take the trophy back to America, the number one. But we'll take number two. We'll learn from our mistakes in the first week. And then, yeah, I guess we'll come back next year and try to get back on the podium in the top spot.
A lot to unpack there in Ricky's comments. He's clearly disappointed, number one.
Yeah, I mean, you can hear it in his voice. He's a champion, and so... when you don't win as a champion, you're not happy. It doesn't matter. That second place is not as sweet as first place.
It doesn't matter if it's 1 second or 2 minutes or 10 minutes. It burns the same because of, you know, the preparation and everything he's put into it.
And you know he's going to be going back and thinking about every mistake that he made in this rally and how he could have corrected it. You know, he's going back to stage one. You heard him say it there. He lost 10 minutes in the first 10 kilometers of the race.
Yeah.
Right there, right off the bat. Forever he'll be going back and
counting
thinking about that. And then every other mistake that he made, he's got them in his head.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember finishing in 2011 and still this day, I think about those mistakes that I made, those days that I got super lost and turned around and lost, you know, 45 minutes and
what could have been.
And like, what if I just did that? What if I just took an extra minute to look at my road book?
Yeah. Well, just like we keep saying, we like doing the what ifs around here, but the Dakar Rally doesn't care about the what ifs. It just has the results at the end of the day.
You know, like I always say is that when you lose time, that time is gone.
Yep.
You can never get it back.
Stop thinking about it. It's gone.
Yep.
The more you worry about it, it's not coming back.
Yeah.
For sure. I think I think his comments on the road book are really telling and showcase what we heard, you know, from the organization before and all the other racers, that navigation wasn't, was tricky. That's what they keep saying. Like it was, it was tricky. It was like not getting lost. It was like hard to pick the one of four options on the road book.
Right. And we've heard a lot of guys talk about, you know, Cap Moy, or, you know, and caps in general. So your cap is your compass heading.
Yep.
Zero to 360. So you'll have a compass heading written on the road book. And then every once in a while, it'll say Cap Moy, M-O-Y, which
more
means,
or less, right?
Yeah. It's basically average cap. So meaning that some of the time you'll be a little to the left of that, and some of the time you'll be a little to the right, but it's going to average out to be 240 degrees or
and then
something.
As you're making averages in the natural world, these are all curves and corners and rocks and sand washes and things like that. So you got to make a judgment call.
Yeah.
And that gets complicated.
Exactly. What is it? You know, what is your, what is an average cap to the guy that's building the road book?
Yeah.
And what is the guy, an average cap to the guy that's reading the road book?
And on top of that, it sounds like there's some road book nomenclature or design that they're not used to seeing. He said multiple notes or caps in one note, not notes, multiple caps in one note. So you scroll up to one frame of the road book and it'll give you three different directions and three different distances. Instead of in three different frames of the road book, they're like, hey, do this, this, and this in the next 200 meters.
Yeah, so this is something that, you know, we haven't really broken down in the show yet. And we've had some people asking about, you know, what an actual road book looks like and how it works. And, you know, without looking at one and trying to explain it, it's tricky. But basically, your road book, you have three boxes.
Yeah.
You have one of the boxes is your mileage or your kilometers.
Yeah, it's just your odometer reading.
Your odometer reading. The next box is basically, it's what's called a tulip. So it's a drawing of the road that you're on.
Yep. Imagine so you're
an intersection.
Imagine your kid drew you directions to get to their bedroom.
Yeah. Just a it's just like a very simple T intersection.
Yeah, with an arrow pointing one direction.
So and then the arrow is pointing the way that you're supposed to go, and then there's a road that's crossed off on the other one.
Don't go that way. Follow the arrow.
So that's the most basic of navigation there. Then the third box, you have your information. So it's usually an abbreviation. Sometimes there will be a cap heading in there, or a compass heading that you have to follow. Sometimes there'll be a
warnings.
Yeah,
danger warnings.
There'll be so there's the organization uses what's called a lexicon of abbreviations.
French abbreviations.
They're all in French. Yep. So, you know, G is left.
It makes sense.
D is right.
Yeah. Okay.
So you know, you,
it's a language you need to study and learn
that first. Yep. So once you learn the French language or the French abbreviations, then you can start to decipher the road book a little bit more.
And all of that's contained in the far right box. So that's like the information data box that gives you the data to follow the tulip picture. So you say tulip picture says go left. The box on the right is going to tell you what cap heading that is. Whether it's
if rocks, the road's rough, or there's ruts, or there's, you know,
Just a bit of information.
Yeah, just a little bit of information.
And
that's
where they're talking about, you know, there's the Moy, which is like more or less 256 degrees.
Yep.
And you're like, it's going to be left 256. So I'm going to pick this one, but that one was 265. And pretty soon you're turning around, coming back and trying to find the right way.
Yeah. And when Ricky says that there were two or three cap headings in one note, you know, that usually means that they want you to change your direction like three times in one small area. So maybe it'll be within, you know, 200 meters that they'll do, you know, you start this curve at 300 degrees.
Yeah.
And then you back off to 320 degrees. And then when you finally leave this intersection, you'll be going 345 degrees.
Yeah. Okay. So it's like, so navigating you through a complicated traffic confluence, but without Google Maps.
Exactly. You know, take the third exit on the right.
Yeah, exactly. But
basically what that is, it's like going around a roundabout and listening to your GPS
on paper
tell you to take the third exit.
out of the roundabout.
And you're like,
towards Barcelona.
Yeah. Got it. Well, I think that the organization did a great job with that road book, confusing and slowing people down enough to make that sort of flip-flop happen every day to make it a really exciting race, as Ricky said. It kept us guessing. It kept, you know, fans watching it being like, how are you going to make up 15 minutes the next day? How's he going to make up 20? He made up all 15 today. Now there's five difference. So it really made it an exciting race.
Absolutely.
What it didn't do at all.
And didn't slow them down.
It was supposed to slow people down.
No, this is the fastest I've ever seen anyone race a Dakar. The speeds are unbelievable.
It's crazy. They just some more stats for you. So just in special test distance that they've raced, and we know they've been on the tap racing this almost every day. They're not cruising around racing. Nobody has said, oh, I had a nice relaxing day. It was fun racing. They were like, whew, that was pretty fast today.
Yeah, ooh, I mean, you go back to that one stage when Beretta averaged 75 miles per hour.
For almost 200 miles.
Yeah.
So
unbelievable.
So here's how this adds up. There's 4,688 kilometers of raced special test distance.
That's on the clock.
That's on the clock. That's 2,912 miles.
Yep.
So that's going to New York from Los Angeles on Interstate 80 and then doing a couple hundred more miles. Yeah. That's how much they raced on the clock. And they averaged the average speed total for the winner, for Kevin, 61.58 miles an hour.
Yeah, that's amazing. You know, that's basically racing Vegas to Reno for 12 days.
That's
for 47 hours and 18 minutes.
Like, you got to let that sink in for a while before it actually makes sense, because it's so astronomically fast and such a big distance that it's hard to comprehend.
Yeah.
For somebody, even if you're driving a truck across the country.
Right.
Air conditioning and a radio and listening to idiots on podcasts, like, that's still going to be kind of grueling and terrible.
It's hard to maintain an average speed like that. And, you know, these guys are, you know, and I think a lot of it comes down to the terrain in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah,
it's just going to be difficult for the organization to slow these guys down.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I don't know what they're going to do in the future with the tire rules. Yeah. Now, I mean, we saw the tire rule was kind of a disaster and maybe made the ASO look bad.
Could have been a big mistake.
Of course, you know, sometimes the French can be a little bit stubborn and maybe they
sadistic.
Say, nope, this is the way it is and you have to deal with it.
Keep dealing with it. It worked. Look, people finished.
Yeah. Everyone made it.
I just think it's got to adjust. Jimmy had a good point yesterday, like limit them to 6 wheel sets and give them a new tire for every day, but don't give them 12 wheel sets. So then you're like at least making them.
Right. You have to save your wheels.
You have to save your wheels a bit, but you get a new tire every day because it's, like you said, no organization in the world is going to put you out on a race course for hundreds of kilometers with zip ties holding your tire together. Like, that's just bananas.
Yeah, yeah. And
in the safety aspect.
I mean, the marathon days, okay, you're stuck with your tire. You know, you have to make it last for 2 days. I think maybe adding multiple marathon stages in would help maybe
shake
make
it up
guys
a little
think
bit.
About conservation a little bit more after we see what happened this year.
I don't think these guys are into conservation.
No, definitely.
So on top of that 2,912 miles of racing, they also rode 4,751 more miles of liaison.
Yeah. sitting on the highway on basically a glorified motocross bike.
Yeah.
I mean, the seats on these things are just rock hard. There's not a lot of comfort factored in when you build a rally bike. And
no,
for me, that was always the worst part of Dakar, was waking up at 3:30 in the morning
and being cold,
freezing your ass off, getting on the bike and trying to ride, you know, knowing you have to ride for 5 hours on the highway and you're just sitting there, no cruise control. You're switching cheeks, you know, left cheek, right cheek, center, forward, scoop back, hang your feet down, whatever you can do to try to get comfortable.
Yeah.
It's hours of punishment before you even get to the start of the race.
And then at least when once you start the special, at least you kind of forget about all the pain and everything because you're engaged and you're working. But man, when you're sitting on the highway, there's nothing to distract you from just the sheer pain and suffering that you're going through.
Yeah, you're just out there in the marathon. You know, you're in the pain cave trying to get through that grueling schedule that they put you in. And it's just so tough. Right. It's so hard.
I mean, this race would be really difficult if you were to just race the specials every day and no liaison.
Yeah.
Then they throw these liaison stages in and all of a sudden it's like, it's got teeth.
Yeah. It's same sort of different scale, but the International 6 Days Enduro is the same way. They do all these special tests and it's all the time, but you talk to the guys afterwards and they're like, the hardest part is riding that same beat trail to and from the bivouac every day because it's just hammered and it's like 4 hours on my dirt bike riding this hammered trail after I got done racing all day. Now I got to come back here and work on my bike. Yeah. Like, this is the hardest part. So pretty interesting. Sam, we talked about him briefly, you know, he's on the podium. It's a great finish for him. Especially, you know, he hasn't had a great history of hitting the podium and finishing.
He hasn't been the most consistent guy and, you know, this is his third Dakar finish in, I don't know, what, eight attempts, I guess, maybe even more, nine.
He won in 2017 and he's been in third position today. I don't think he was on the podium.
Yeah. So
other than that,
I mean, you know, solid, consistent ride. He played the consistent strategy.
Yeah.
But I just don't think he had it in the tank to really turn up the speed and compete with the Hondas. And, you know, we saw it today. His race basically just kind of came apart at the seams and, you know, he lost a big chunk of time to the two Hondas and, you know, bumped him out of second place. But I mean, this is probably the toughest Dakar in a very, very long time. And, you know, every single one of these guys is a badass. And, you know, you see
that goes for sure without saying.
Yeah, some of the best riders in the world, you know, were just worn down and
annihilated,
just chewed up and spit out by this race.
Yeah, we're comparing like heroes to other heroes at this point. Sam did lose 13 minutes today. Let's hear from him. I got a quote from Sam here.
Yeah, you know, I did my best job, so I cannot be so disappointed. I tried so hard this morning and started off good, and then I couldn't find one WPC in the dunes, searching there for 10 minutes. And, you know, it's like that. When you push the speed, the navigation comes down because it's this fine balance. And I knew today that I had to try. I had a big task ahead of me to open and finish in front of Ricky, and it was I tried my best, you know, and it wasn't possible, and I made a mistake with the navigation there. And but look, I'm super happy. I gave my best all the race, and I was the third best guy. The other guys did a great job, and congratulations to them.
And you are the first KTM rider at the end.
Yeah, for sure. You know, it's a bit sad for Toby crashing out there. And but yeah, look, we're here. We're healthy and happy. A podium at Dakar is never a bad thing, you know. You know, in the Dakar, is so many factors involved to finish in the top 10, let alone on the podium. And you know, there's so many days, so many situations, and it's not easy. So the best man in the end wins, and today it wasn't us. So it's a race, and it's why we come here to fight. And I have big respect to the guys and to everybody that's finished.
We can see that the level of the top 10 riders has a lot increased. Do you agree?
Yeah, the pace this year was incredibly high, and the guys opening the route was doing a great job and fast also, not really losing so much time after the first days. And really tough race, but the toughest race I ever did. You know, I'm really tired in my head and body, and I'm happy to be finished. Really, really tough, but it should be like that, I guess.
A lot of respect from Sam to the guys that hung it out there and constantly led out with a lot of speed.
Yeah. And, you know, very, very impressive performance by all these guys. You know, it's really cool to hear Sam, you know, show the respect for what the two Honda guys have done and, you know, in their training and their navigation. And I think that the level has jumped up this year.
Yeah.
It's a new game.
They were all three of them separated by about 7 minutes yesterday, and that gap grew to 15 to third place.
Yep.
For Sam today.
And
fourth place
on the rally.
Another KTM guy.
And the rookie,
Daniel Sanders.
This kid has had a tough race, man.
He's beat up, stung by bees.
Yeah, he's soldiered it out. I mean, he looks haircut. Like he got a bad plastic surgery job yesterday, and his lips swelled up.
Yeah, he got some bumblebee Botox on the top lip there, and it didn't do him any favors. But this guy's got big future ahead. So when Toby Price started his Dakar career, he finished third in his first year. So Sanders coming in a really tough year, getting fourth. That's pretty good sign for his future.
It's really good sign. He didn't just luck into this one. He had to work for it.
Yep.
And you know, I don't know if you asked him today if he wants to come back and do it again. Yes, next year he may not be so keen to
super quick to have
a factory rally ride. But I think you know you give him a month or so to kind of digest what has all happened and everything. And then I think he'll probably be back on board to race yesterday.
He's coming back for sure. He's a gritty Australian. Those guys don't quit very easily or get intimidated by things that are difficult. He's going to be back super strong. So gap to him was 38 minutes. So still we're within an hour of these guys. And after 47 hours, that's really impressive.
Yep.
Next guy, we got to give one of the most impressive performances of the rally. Obviously, the people that win are the most impressive, I would say. But Skyler Howes coming into this race, full privateer, invested a ton of money into getting on a good team, good bikes, good people behind him. That's about all he could do. He didn't have a ton of time preparing. He didn't have a ton of time on the bike before this race.
Yeah, I mean, he was
working. Didn't do a lot of road books. He was working.
Yeah, he was working. He was busy
working at a machine shop,
it's really awesome to see Skyler finish in fifth. And you know, again, he didn't just luck into this. I mean,
no.
He was up there mixing it up with the top guys and on one of the fastest, most competitive Dakars in history. You know, sometimes you see at the end of a race or end of a rally, okay, well, all these guys dropped out and this and that. And so he just kind of like, put himself in a good spot and then he finished in the top 10 and da, 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 da. So, but not this year, man. He was battling it out and wearing these guys down. He actually led the rally at one point overall, which is
amazing.
Impressive.
Yeah. And finished third in a stage. Coming into the rally, he had realistic expectations to improve on his ninth place finish last year. And he knew that if he, you know, had a little bit better luck and a little bit more experience, he could do it. And man, he just turned people's heads, finishing fifth overall. He's 52 minutes behind. Admittedly learned from a lot of his mistakes on the way, which I think shows a lot of maturity and, you know, shows just a really good racing mindset.
Yeah, and you know, I think he's set himself up perfectly for, you know, a top factory team to, you know,
have
a good look at him. And I mean, he beat a lot of the factory guys, and he's, you know, he's looking good for next year. So hopefully, we see him on a Husqvarna or a KTM factory ride, or who knows, maybe even Honda. I don't know.
Who knows?
I think this may be Beretta's last year of his Honda contract. So. Maybe we see two Americans on that Honda team.
We'll have some Dakar Rally Silly Season podcast coming up soon when we get some contract details rolling around. So shout out to Skyler. He's been great with us, you know, talking to us repeatedly during the race, and so pumped for him to finish it up in fifth place. Very cool sixth place guy, and I'm not going to go down the whole list here, obviously, but I wanted to give Santolino a shout out because he's on a Sherco factory bike in sixth place. I like seeing a bunch of different bike manufacturers in the top contention because it means the sport's healthy. It means these people are investing a ton of money, time, and it just gives people more options out there. And to see a small brand like Sherco almost bust into the top five at this Dakar rally is pretty awesome. Pretty amazing.
Very, very impressive for Sherco. I mean, this is, you know, I don't know what their best finish ever is at a Dakar, but I got to say, this is pretty darn close.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
and he's been kind of quietly consistent, just held it, kind of held it together. He was pretty high in the general for a while there and then, you know, dropped back a little bit, but, you know, we really didn't hear a lot from him, but, you know, very, very consistent guy.
And yeah.
Look at that. Sixth overall for the Sherco.
Pretty cool. I mean, the whole top 10 is full of impressive people. You know, Stefan Svitko, that guy's a legend. He's done so many of these races, and he's just awesome to see. But
absolutely. And
Wagner.
Matthias Wagner.
Coming back from 2.5 hours down.
Yeah. I mean, second stage had a freak clutch failure and lost 2.5 hours. And look at him. I mean, he's about 2.5 hours.
He's
back.
Literally 2.5 hours from the finish, from the lead. So shows his speed, his composure, and his skill.
And you know, Matthias is he's a great rider. You know, former MX3 world champion. He Austrian guy who actually grew up very close to Madenkoven, and he used to work at KTM. He was a test rider in R&D, and his brother Gerald is actually a colleague of mine. He works in R&D.
In Austria,
and so I test with his brother quite often, and they look almost identical.
Big Austrian,
it's pretty funny, yeah.
Badass Austrian twins out there.
Super good guys, and you know, just it's cool to see him actually crack back into the top 10 after that massive failure on the second stage.
Yeah, you know, we did have a lot of people drop out of this race due to crashes, unfortunately, but.
And
those are
failures.
I was going to say that's one thing crashing when you're pushing it out there, but Yamaha, even today, their last hope of getting one of their factory rally bikes on the podium or even
just
close
to the finish line,
just evaporated about 30 km. Adrian Van Beveren, I'm a fan, but he couldn't bring the Yamaha back. And that means that every Yamaha either crashed out, or DNF'd on mechanical. I think they basically all
had mechanical failures. I mean, Andrew was, you could say that's not really a mechanical, but
it filled up with water.
It wasn't a crash.
Yeah, it wasn't a crash. Nobody. Yeah. So really, really terrible for Yamaha to put all that time and money in and then have that happen.
I mean, that's a tough one to swallow for a manufacturer.
Yeah.
And you know, Japan is looking at that team, and no matter how you spin it, it's a stain on their reputation, and they really need to go back to the drawing board and figure out what's going on with these engines and get it worked out. Cause I feel like they have a good bike. They have a good chassis. It's fast. It's strong, stable. It looks like it handles really well, but
if the engine failures are the issue that are keeping you from finishing this race, there's gotta be some growth there that you can get through. And we've seen, like, Honda went through this. Honda had electrical gremlins and bikes starting on fire
failures.
And engine failures on second to last stage with Ricky leading. Like, this isn't uncommon in this grueling world, but to almost have your R&D happen during the race and find these things shows that you got a lot more work to do.
Yeah, that's not a good look for them for sure. And you see Yamaha, they're trying, they're making an effort, but I don't think that they don't have the budget that Honda has put into this thing. You know, they're a much smaller team and they're investing a lot of money, but
we're talking a lot of money on Honda's behalf.
I would doubt that it's a quarter of what Honda invests into this thing. And so, you know, they're working with a little bit smaller budget and maybe not as much support from Japan. So,
right. It could either extinguish all plans to expand, or it could just light the fire underneath them and be like, that's it. We're going to invest in what it takes to be massively competitive in this. And then, hopefully
that's the way it goes. And then they go back to the drawing board and they really get their durability figured out. And, we see them competitive next year.
What a crazy race, guys. It's blowing me away still every day.
Yep. And, you know, my favorite rider in the rally finishing 17th overall, which is just unbelievable. And we had an interview with Laia Sainz early on, but
she's
racing this race with Lyme's disease.
Yep. She was diagnosed with Lyme disease. You guys got to check that interview out. if you want to be inspired by somebody. So not only is she beating a lot of people and finishing 17th in the rally, but this is the record that you need to pay attention to. She's raced every Dakar rally since 2011, and she's finished every one.
Yeah.
And her most of her finishes are around this 15th. She finished as high as 9th overall.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a female racer finishing in the top 10 overall. You know, she's riding the factory Gas Gas bike this year, and just she continues to impress me. I mean,
yeah, it's almost
people don't realize how hard it is to finish in the top 20 at a race like this.
I mean, all we've been talking about is how beat up these guys are and how grueling it is and how fast they're going, and she is right there.
Yeah. So definite badass.
Oh man. She's cool. I think you just need to look her up and learn about her as much as you can. She's a multi-time world champion, trials bike champion, enduro champion, and Dakar badass for sure.
Yep. I mean, like I said, and then to go into it with such a strange disease like Lyme's disease and just say, hey, I'm not ready. My body's not ready. I'm not in shape.
Yep.
I've been fighting this all year, but I'm going to go for it anyway.
Yeah. I want to finish another one. I'm not going to go and not finish. Yeah. Her interview is great. Go check that out. Man, I don't know what else to say about Dakar Rally. It's blowing me away, man.
Yeah. You know, I think some of the takeaways from this race this year is that there's a few guys that have raised the game.
Definitely.
It's become just a war of attrition.
Yep. It's combining massive skill at roadbook navigation and being the most durable and also having this ace in your hole, which is being able to hang it out and go as fast as everybody else. And the preparation that the Honda team has been doing, and I think a lot of this comes down to the beat down they're taking here in America on these roadbook training things and the skill that they're learning. And obviously the team building extremely durable machines to get to the finish is really paying off. And I think every time one of the other teams has commented on the guys leading out, it's been the Honda guys.
Yep, for sure. And you know, a lot of that comes from kind of our little crew here in the US and the Jimmy Lewis, Johnny Campbell crew. They're training really hard with navigation, and they're training in the desert.
Yep. They're training in the terrain that they're going to be racing in, basically.
Right. And a lot of the European guys don't have that option, so it makes it a little bit more difficult for them. COVID definitely turned things on its head this year.
For sure.
Maybe some of the guys, you know, who are based out of Europe and Australia and some of the KTM guys had a harder time training than, say, Ricky Brabec or, you know, Nacho Conejo was over here in the U.S. for a long time training.
Yeah, if you listen to Toby Price interview we did at the beginning, he hasn't been home in 6 or 7 months, 5 months. He hasn't been home. He's been in Europe, in Dubai, riding. But, like, he doesn't have that comfort of being at home or regular cycle or any of that stuff. He hasn't seen his friends, like his family.
Yeah, it's been a tough year
for everybody.
Yeah, to be on a training program but not, you know, not be at home, not be living somewhere where you can train. He's living
rest.
In hotels and sleeping on friends' couches. I mean,
yeah, who knows? You
know, who knows where he's been? So it was basically just a game of wearing each other out, going as fast as you can and waiting for the other guy to crack.
Yep. And unfortunately, we did see quite a few people go down. You know, I think Xavier De Soltre was the first guy to go out with a crash injury. And then, you know, Toby went out, Nacho, Joanne went out.
Yep.
These were all guys that were in the top contention.
Yeah, guys that had led the rally at some point.
Yep. And that's the scary part about that race when you think of it, you know, as just a normal person sitting here. Like, these guys are risking their lives, like Ricky said, after Toby went down. Every day they put their boots on. So it's intense. I hope everybody listening gets that impression from this. That's kind of the point we came into this with, was like, expose exactly what these guys are getting through every day, because it's phenomenal, really. I don't know how to put it into words other than, like, the math just speaks for itself. You can't go 60 miles an hour for 47 hours.
Yeah. And not be a superhuman over the bars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
the odds are just going to, something's going to catch up to you.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's hopefully that we kind of were able to help some people digest this a little bit better. And, you know, this is something that Jesse and I just kind of took on as a, hey, that'd be kind of cool if somebody did that.
Yeah. Cause we're super fans.
Have you ever done a podcast before, Jesse?
No. Yeah. I just started
just
one.
20.
I've done 21 of them.
21. Yeah. Just, you know, this is the first time either one of us have done a podcast or anything like it. And so we're hoping that everybody enjoyed it. And, you know, we want to try to do a couple follow-up shows. We're going to break some stuff down, get some interviews with some of the guys once they get home. And, you know,
we'll keep
maybe
it going.
Yeah, maybe do a show kind of explaining how you can get into this sport if you want to do a smaller rally or, you know, learn and what it takes to actually get to Dakar.
Yeah, because it's not impossible. If you watch some of this stuff, it seems impossible. Like, most people aren't going to go here and average 60 miles an hour, but the sport is attainable and the experience is attainable. And once you do it, I know I've done a road book before. It's a different way of riding a motorcycle because you're fully engaged all the time.
Yeah. And
it's like a really good trail ride and you don't remember where you were all day.
It's addicting too.
It's definitely addicting. That's why we're sitting here talking. So,
you know, you look down the results and the majority of these guys are just average guys that are, that have a dream to race the Dakar. And, you know, it's similar to people climbing Mount Everest, you know, it's a bucket list item. And if you look down to our, you know, there were 63 motorcycles that finished out of, what did we have? 113 or 111 starters
something like
or something.
That.
So
roughly half the field finished.
Yeah. 63 finishers. And the last guy on the list here took him 113 hours and 31 minutes. So,
This is Alexander. He's from Botswana. He is Ross Branch's buddy. They ride together.
Really?
Yeah, I saw a little piece on this, and Ross Branch is like, you should go do it. And he's like, okay, I'll try it. But he finished today.
Yeah, and he was 66 hours behind the leader.
Yeah, but
hey,
whatever.
But he did it.
He's out for a really cool trail ride. He's navigating by a road book every day, and he made it.
And imagine the stories that guy has. I'm pretty sure there had to have been a few days where he came in the dark, maybe on a tow rope.
Definitely in the dark. Yeah, definitely. So he came in the dark.
That's something we want to touch on in future shows, is how the average guy can get to Dakar and do this. And, you know, if you're willing to make the investment, it's an experience that you will never, ever, ever, ever forget.
Yeah, it'll be branded into your brain and your soul. Thanks, everybody, for listening. I've been having a great time geeking out about this, and now I'm more addicted to this stupid sport than ever.
Yeah. So I think now we can go and maybe sleep in tomorrow and then try to just grovel and earn back some credit with our wives.
A little bit respect at home. You know, I got to do a lot of chores.
We both have two kids that are under 5 years old, and now they're at home doing homeschool, and you know.
Yeah.
So if you want to sponsor our show here, we easily accept gift cards for the wives to maybe smooth some of this over so that we can maybe have the opportunity to do it again next year.
Yeah, we don't need anything. We just need to run some interference at the home game.
Without their permission, this isn't coming back.
And I want to make it clear that I did not have permission.
Yeah.
I kind of just did this and I am in trouble.
We kind of didn't tell our wives we were going to do this, really. We were just like, oh yeah, we're going to do this podcast thing. And
yeah.
Every single morning for 2 weeks.
It's cool. We made it. And they're still at home. They haven't left us.
Yeah. For now.
For now.
All right. Get out of here and get home. No, I got to go to work. I forgot about that part too.
Yeah. Me too.
I'm late today.
Coming up, we're going to be doing.
My boss isn't listening.
We're going to do some more shows, some follow-up interviews. And we do have a couple more interviews still to post that you're going to be interested in. So stay tuned. Keep subscribing. Keep listening. And thank you so much. It's been real fun.